Pushkin. Imagine there's a place in our world where the known things go. Like old modems. Or at the end of this brightly lit hallway, towers of computer servers. A little city of miniature skyscrapers. This vault, this data center, stores the facts that matter and matters of fact. It's all that stands between a reasonable doubt and the chaos of uncertainty. The sign on the door reads, "The Last Archive." Step through the door to Washington, D.C., Capitol Hill, July 26, 1966, a Tuesday. The United States was mired in a terrible war in Vietnam. Americans were engaged in a struggle for civil rights at home. There'd been riots on the streets of American cities, protests of all kinds, anti-war marches, student demonstrations. To a lot of people, it felt as if the country was coming apart. Inside the office building of the House of Representatives, room 2247, hearings were about to begin. Hearings that weren't about any of those protests. Hearings that were about computer data.
The subcommittee will come to order.
Just after 10 a.m., Cornelius E. Gallagher, a Democratic congressman from New Jersey, took his seat.
The Special Subcommittee on Invasion of Privacy today begins its investigation into proposals to establish a national data center, a centralized facility within the structure of the national government into which would be poured information collected from various government agencies and from which computers could draw selected facts.
At the time, more than 3 billion government records were stored on punch cards and magnetic tape, housed in over 20 different federal agencies. So many facts scattered all over the place. It was a mess. So the Johnson administration said, how about building a national data center? It'd gather all the computer records of every federal agency, all in one place, the same way the Library of Congress holds books, or the National Archives holds manuscripts. Seems straightforward enough. Congressman Gallagher, though, he thought this was a terrifying idea.
If safeguards are not built into such a facility, it could lead to the creation of what I call the computerized man. The computerized man, as I see him, would be stripped of his individuality and his privacy.
Congress is one of those lagging indicators of American fears. By the time a fear gets articulated on Capitol Hill, it's already been infecting the population for a while. Think about the times Congress has brought in baby-faced Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg to ask him about computers and the invasion of privacy.
Mr. Zuckerberg, would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
I think that may be what this is all about. Your right to privacy.
It was too late. Congress is very often too late. Remember last episode about the defeat of national health insurance? Congress. Too little, too late. The National Data Center, it's a forgotten sequel to that story about national health insurance. Welcome to The Last Archive, the show about how we know what we know and about how it seems lately as if we don't know anything anymore. I'm Jill Lepore. But of course, you can know things. For instance, you can know a lot of things by listening to old congressional hearings and asking questions like, what the hell ever happened to the National Data Center? And did anyone listen to Congress in the 1960s when it issued ominous warnings about a future in which we'd all be stalked and haunted and tortured by that freak, that monster, computerized man? Everyone in the whole world seems to have forgotten about those hearings in 1966. But forgetting about them means we keep having them all over again. It's like the horror movie where you think you've killed the monster and then he digs himself out of his own grave and comes after you with the same rusty, bloody axe. Cornelius Gallagher, the Democrat who chaired the committee, wasn't the only member of Congress who was really worried about data and privacy. After Gallagher called the meeting to order, he was followed by Frank Horton, a Republican, who felt more or less the same way about the whole thing as Gallagher did.
I have become convinced that the magnitude of the problem we now confront is akin to the changes wrought in our national life with the dawning of the nuclear age. Assuming the best for a moment, let us regard our computer systems as good and fair, and the computer men behind the console as honest and capable.
That was the best case scenario. God forbid the machines were bad and unfair, and the computer men dishonest and incompetent. By the way, the term computer scientist didn't really exist then. They were called computer men, which I like better anyway because it makes it sound as if they're half computer, half man. Anyway, there were all kinds of reasons the federal government wanted a national data center. For one, the government had taken on problems of bigger and bigger scale. A social security program. The building of atomic weapons. The government needed to collect and to conduct statistical analysis of data that had to do with things like healthcare and economic development and racial justice. Lyndon Johnson's administration needed that information to fight the war on poverty. It also needed that information to implement the oversight requirements of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act. To do those things, it needed what we would call big data. Modern life required taller and taller piles of facts, numbers, and data. Piles of data so tall that they had to be handled by computers. And remember, this was decades before the personal computer, before people had their own computers and knew how to use them. Which meant that people had to be willing to put a whole lot of trust in the very small number of people, mainly men, who knew how to run those machines, those computer men. Because of that, it seemed as if computer men had all kinds of information about you, and they seemed to have limitless powers.
Assuming a computer man who was dishonest, unscrupulous, or bent on injury, there would be nothing sacred. We could be destroyed.
Whoa, so crazy start to those hearings. We could all be destroyed. Then Gallagher called his first witness.
The subcommittee is very fortunate this morning in having as its first witness in this series of hearings Mr. Vance Packard. Mr. Packard is more responsible than any man in our country for alerting us to the dangers that lurk in the twilight of our sophisticated society.
The then famous, if now sadly much forgotten, Mr. Vance Packard. I guess we'd now call this guy an influencer. He wasn't an academic, but he was often mistaken for one. And I'm sorry, but I love this guy. In 1966, he was a 52-year-old social critic. And he was most famous for a book called The Naked Society, in which he'd issued a warning about the loss of privacy. The book spent 23 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Packard had written a whole series of bestsellers, a lot of them about things I've been talking about here in the Last Archive: lie detectors, targeted advertising, data surveillance. The Times, in a profile, described him as a man who acts on the whole like a professor at a small college, a little unsure of tenure. This was actually a gentle way of saying that Packard was incredibly boring to listen to. But the Times reporter added, "At the typewriter, he is something else again." In other words, in person, Vance Packard was a dud. But on the page, Vance Packard was a stud. Sometimes newspapers referred to Packard as a sociologist. This really tugged at the well-trimmed beards of the nation's actual sociologists. One social science journal published an entire issue trying to answer the question, "Is Vance Packard necessary?" You'd feel bad for the guy, except that he was a famously happy man and untroubled by his critics. Packard liked to work in bed. He'd spend hours a day lying there. He'd clip stories from newspapers and magazines and read through them. He played the banjo. He swam in the ocean bare-assed every morning. He was famously thrifty. In the winter, he wore two pairs of pants, one on top of the other, to stay warm. Famously thrifty, famously kooky. But either way, very, very famous.
We are indeed honored and privileged to have you open these hearings today, Mr. Packard. Please proceed.
Cornelius Gallagher welcomed him to the hearings with enthusiasm.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. Records on individual Americans now number in the billions. We leave a trail of records behind us from the moment of birth The individual citizen who is concerned about the erosion of his privacy has, up until now, had some consolation in the knowledge that all these files about his life have been widely dispersed and often difficult to get at.
Are we getting prematurely overheated in our concern?
I do not think you are getting prematurely overheated at all. I think we should all be scared stiff about the possibility that these giant machines would be fed data about individual Americans, and that this information would be retrievable by a number of different organizations or groups. I think this would clearly create the preconditions for a totalitarian system.
It went on like that. On the first day of the hearings, nearly everyone agreed with Packard, down to the last witness.
Adjourned.
I got to wondering whether people outside of Congress were worried about the National Data Center. And once I started looking, man, they were everywhere. The New York Times said the data center would bring the United States closer to an Orwellian nightmare. "Big Brother Never Rests," ran the headline in the Indianapolis Star. From pulpits, priests and ministers and rabbis denounced the idea. Another newspaper called it a giant peeping Tom. And I'm not kidding, even the Daughters of the American Revolution, the DAR, passed a resolution against the data center. But what about just regular people? Almost everyone who wrote to Gallagher about the National Data Center was opposed to it.
"Dear sir, it is good to know that your committee is alert to the dangers of this Gestapo scheme of the president. I'm Jean Armstrong, El Paso, Texas."
A lot of the letter writers feared a vast government conspiracy, a socialist conspiracy, or a communist conspiracy. Let me just add here that in the 1960s, this sort of cockamamie thing got sent by the Postal Service and read by one person or maybe two, and then they got filed in a drawer. Today, this stuff is on 4chan or Twitter, read possibly by thousands, clicked on and linked to. I always think about that when I read these old letters, that no one has heard these voices since 1966, and that really hardly anyone heard them then.
"Dear sir, what better way to inaugurate a police state? Already we have creeping socialism in our government. God help us. Yours truly, Donald F. Hammond, Flagstaff, Arizona."
Gallagher was a Democrat, a liberal, a supporter of Johnson's Great Society. But the citizens who wrote to him on this topic were chiefly conservatives. Also, there was a lot of talk about dossiers.
"Dear Mr. Gallagher, a word of thanks for bringing to light of day the machinations of the White House task force employed in the Soviet-like procedure of turning every U.S. citizen into a little white rabbit for governmental dissection, brainwashing, and intimidation via the dossier process. Sincerely, Elizabeth Nash, Front Royal, Virginia."
A lot of these letter writers were from what was then the very far fringe of the American right. Anti-government kooks, white supremacists, John Birchers, conspiracy theorists.
"Dear Mr. Gallagher, please kill the idea of a central data bank. This looks like communist infiltration. Also kill the civil rights bill, especially fair housing. Jail Martin Luther King for inciting rebellion. Most sincerely, Frank P. Sterling, Oakland, California, veteran, World War I.
"Dear Congressman, the federal government is already operating too much of our business, controlling our manufacturing, interfering in our medical establishments, taking over our educational facilities and procedures. The great society now demands to have prior control and jurisdiction over even our personal thoughts. Guess we might just as well move to Moscow. Please, do everything in your power to defeat and rout these enemies of freedom and liberty. James S. Christie, Upper Darby, Pennsylvania."
The congressman started to get a little worried. He'd write back, trying to calm these people down.
"Dear Mr. Christie, while I appreciate your support of my inquiry,
I can neither agree with your views that the federal government is taking over our rights, nor that the Great Society is the instrument for such action. Sincerely, Cornelius E. Gallagher.
Remember, though, that at the time there was also just a lot of anxiety about computers, and especially men who were obsessed with them. In the 1960s, Americans were terrified, too, of another machine. The war machine that was calling up young men, number by number, for the draft, to go to Vietnam. Before 1966, the kids of the middle class, the college students, they got educational deferments or some other dispensation. But by 1966, the number of young men called up to the draft every month was being raised from 17,000 to 35,000. That meant that for the first time, middle-class white men, boys really, were being sent to Vietnam. Meantime, the war began to seem, as in fact it was, hopeless and immoral. The Vietnam War was the first war whose every move was plotted by computer. Johnson's Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, was a systems analyst, a computer man, who appeared to be running this war with a giant computer that could calculate a victory index. Johnson said, "There is no computer that can tell the hour and the day of peace." But apparently there was. As the story has it, people at the Pentagon fed all kinds of data into that computer. Population, gross national product, manufacturing capability, the number of tanks, ships, and aircraft, the size of the armed forces. And then, about 1967 or so, men at the Pentagon went down to the basement and asked that giant computer, which had run all those numbers, "When will we win the war?" And the computer spat out these words. "You won in 1964. Conservatives hated Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and big government, and liberals were getting angrier and angrier about Vietnam, seeing it as a war being waged by the ruthless, relentless mindlessness of a giant electronic brain. That meant that things looked bad for the establishment of a national data center. On the last day of Gallagher's hearings, July 28, 1966, a witness appeared, Paul Barron of RAND Corporation, a 40-year-old Polish-born computer man. Barron had grown up in Philadelphia. He'd worked for the Remington RAND Company, the company that made the UNIVAC, the machine that CBS had hired for election night in 1952. Barron was brilliant.
"Suppose we build our future systems without any safeguards at all, and all information. This whole list of records that we accumulate during our life is available in various systems."
Barron told the committee something it hadn't expected to hear and couldn't really understand. He admitted that a national data center could destroy privacy as we know it. But then he told the committee that it actually didn't matter whether or not the national data center was built. It didn't require a building, because data was about to get all linked up anyway.
"Whether the information is centralized in one central data bank or whether it is spread around the country doesn't make a darn bit of difference. The result is the same."
"Basically, we could sum up, Mr. Barron, that we certainly should not attempt to impede the growth of technology, but at the same time, we should start devoting more time to building in the safeguards so that this technology can serve man rather than subordinate him to its decision."
"That's right. I don't think we're going to be able to stop technology. I think that decision is not ours. But what we can do is provide all the safeguards we possibly can."
Barron's position came down to this. You can't stop technology, and you can't stop people from collecting data. But you can make data safer if you act right now, he told the committee. "Please do something. Set up a national data center, or don't set up a national data center. Just do something. Set up some rules, establish principles, before it's too late. Because unless the government comes up with a way to understand what data is and what can be done with it, we'll be left wandering around in a world where anyone can collect data about anything and do whatever they want with it."
"The Special Subcommittee of Invasion of Privacy is adjourned."
God damn it! The House investigation ended and they didn't come up with any rules. But then the Senate decided to hold its own hearings. I've got the tapes, stored here in this data center, in the halls of the Last Archive. The Senate held its own hearings about the National Data Center a few months after the House, in March of 1967. Its chief witness was a then-unknown law school professor from the University of Michigan. He was 32 at the time. He's in his 80s now. I called him up.
I'm Arthur Miller. I'm a university professor at NYU with a long tour at Harvard Law School, and I wrote in 1971 a book called The Assault on Privacy, which some say saw the future.
Miller's retired now. For a long time, in the 1970s and 1980s, he had a TV show called Miller's Court.
On an upcoming Miller's Court, we'll be talking about the draft, a subject everyone has an opinion on.
I watched it when I was a kid. I thought it was like free law school. Miller really is a made-for-TV law professor. He's nimble, witty, combative. He's a very distinctive style. He wears three-piece suits with flashy ties.
Isn't it time for your day in court?
I wanted to know how Miller got roped into testifying before the Senate hearing. He said it all started when he got a phone call from the office of Senator Sam Ervin, a Democrat from North Carolina, who's best known as the guy who chaired the Watergate hearings.
My phone rings. It's the staffer from the Senate committee, Ervin's committee.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, we'd like you to be the lead witness on this hearing that we're going to hold on the National Data Center. And I say to the staffer, I don't know a thing about privacy. And he says, well, we're told that you've written about it. And I said, no, I've written about computers and privacy. And he says, hang on. And the senator gets on the phone. What do you mean you don't know anything about privacy? And he says, I still want you as the lead witness in these hearings. Senator, I know nothing about privacy. And he screams into the phone, well, learn, damn it.
Miller says, okay, I'll do it. You don't say no to Sam Ervin. So he reads up. I asked him why so many people had gotten worked up about the National Data Center.
It just seemed like a damn good political issue that crossed Republican and Democratic lines because mm-hmm. when you're dealing with privacy, you're into the world of humanism, and the Democrats can rally around that, and the Republicans can rally around not creating big government that knows everything about you. The problem was that some people saw the government as the devil. Personally, I was concerned that there were no constraints on the broad outlines of the system that was being proposed.
So, March 1967, Arthur Miller gets dressed up, three-piece suit, flashy tie, pocket handkerchief. He goes to the hearing in the Senate. Sadly, it wasn't recorded. But Miller tells the senators, with his usual flair, that it's stupid to oppose a technological development that will widen the sphere of knowledge just because it might be misused.
I was not Carrie Nation with an axe out to smash the machines. Never have been. I was looking for rational controls. And the problem back then was not only was no one looking at that, but the high technology people didn't know how to do it.
Miller agreed with that RAND guy, Paul Barron, who testified before the House a few months earlier. Barron said data collection was going to happen, and it wouldn't require an actual building like the Library of Congress or the National Archives. It would just be there, floating around like a cloud. The House and the Senate were supposed to keep on thinking about the National Data Center, but instead, they tabled it. Everything, including the questions it had raised about data and privacy. Basically, they hoped everyone would forget about it. They'd killed the monster and buried him. 1 month after the Senate hearings where Miller testified, the first big, really big protest against the Vietnam War took place in New York. Martin Luther King spoke out against the war.
We, the participants in today's unprecedented national peace demonstration, are united in our conviction of the imperative need for an immediate, peaceful solution to an illegal and unjustifiable war.
That fall, Robert McNamara, Lyndon Johnson's Secretary of Defense, resigned. A few months later, Johnson shocked the country when he announced that he would not run for re-election in 1968. The Great Society was over, and the proposal for a national data center was dead. What do you think was lost in the way that defeat happened?
When one looks at the National Data Center, it's child's play. It's fun for the feeble-minded. it was basically a statistical system. Its ability to harm was limited.
Yeah. So that's exactly squarely what fascinates me about this story is, looking back, was there ever a moment, and if there was it that moment in 66 or 67 when maybe we could have ushered in a set of principles that might have spared us the course we're now seeming to be doomed to?
If somebody had said, hey, this national data center, great idea, sleek, efficient, economical, but we better take 2 years out and figure out the deleterious side effects of it. If that occurred, the possibility that we shot ourselves in the foot because we defeated it may have been a reality. But I assure you, back in 66, 7, 8, 9, 70, there was no ability to do that.
In other words, a better version of the National Data Center never had a chance in the 1960s because people just couldn't wrap their heads around it. Or some people could. They could see what was coming, but not enough people to really do something about it, like make those rules and build those safeguards. You probably know what happened next. Killing the National Data Center didn't mean the end of data.
It was then followed by years of expanded governmental and private systems, which in effect gives you a national data center, maturing into today's world, which is, in fact, the womb to tomb dossier.
Womb to tomb, cradle to grave, data chronicles every moment of your life. And that data is entirely unregulated. Even as the National Data Center was being buried, a new monster was rising. The internet, or at least what would become the internet, was first demonstrated in 1972 in the ballroom of a hotel in Washington, D.C. The ballroom floor looked like the bottom of the ocean, a huge octopus splayed across it, its tentacles so many cables tangled in a seaweed of telephone lines and electrical cords. Technicians had set up 29 different terminals, each at its own station. Bob Kahn, a computer man, had organized the demo of what was called ARPANET, the Computerized Network of the Department of Defense's Advanced Research Projects Agency, or ARPA. People had been trying to build it for a long time, but it had never gotten finished, and Kahn figured they needed a deadline to give them a kick in the pants. So can you tell me a little bit what the mood was like in the ballroom during that week?
Well, it was, I would say, exuberant. I mean, it was like what you'd find in Times Square at 11:30, waiting for New Year's to happen. I mean, everybody was excited. They knew they were part of, something important.
Were you hoping to get reporters to come write about this, or it was really just for internally, for the community of people who were working on the system?
We weren't looking to try and advertise. I mean, like, did the Wright brothers have the press there when they had their first... air flight? I don't know. Maybe they didn't know if they'd get off the ground.
The news that day, October 24th, 1972, all had to do with the upcoming presidential election, which was just 2 weeks away. Henry Kissinger had just gotten back to Washington after a trip to Vietnam. A young Joe Biden was turning heads in his upstart Senate campaign in Delaware. The Washington Post had just broken a story reported by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, an update about a break-in at the offices of the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate Hotel. Meanwhile, over at the ARPANET demo at the Washington Hilton, a lot of wonderful and thrilling goofiness. The idea was to demonstrate that computers could talk to other computers. What they'd actually talk about didn't seem to matter much. The big idea was computers were changing from being storage devices to being also communication devices. It was amazing.
My name is Timmy the Terminal. What is yours?
Jill Lepore.
So you could sit in DC, follow the instructions in a brochure, and chat with a program running out of UCLA.
Pleased to meet you, Jill Lepore. Have we met before?
No.
Sorry, but I have a terrible memory for names. Anyway, my job is to answer your questions, so ask away.
When will this computer crash next?
About 5 o'clock.
Timmy the Terminal. Clippy the Paperclip's grandfather. Some of these programs were really interesting, promising. Some of them are just unbelievably exciting. The Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab had established a connection to the Associated Press's news hotline. Any terminal on that network could be turned into an AP news line using a program called HOT, HOT. With this program linked to the AP wire service, you could read through all the latest news updates. You could even search by keyword. It was the very first version of what we would call a news feed.
H-O-T.
Associated Press News.
Nixon.
12 news items found. Read which ones.
Which Richard Nixon story you might want to follow in October 1972? Hard to say. There were too many to choose from. Weeks after the ARPANET demo, Nixon was re-elected with an incredible 60% of the popular vote. When it became clear just how huge Nixon's victory was going to be, an anchor at ABC News called a correspondent over where the Nixon campaign was celebrating.
Well, in Washington, President Nixon's number one domestic affairs advisor is John Ehrlichman, and David Shoemaker is with him now in the Shoreham Hotel in Washington. David?
Howard, he feels too good. I'm going to ask him whatever happened to Watergate.
I don't know. Apparently nothing.
In spite of all those investigations by Woodward and Bernstein, Ehrlichman was confident that there was nothing going on. But of course, there was a lot going on. It led to an investigation and to a House impeachment inquiry. After 2 long years of scandal and strife, on August 9th, 1974, President Nixon went on live television and resigned.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body.
The story of Watergate is a story of illicit knowledge. The real monster, ill-gotten evidence, bad governance. Nixon's administration had bugged DNC headquarters at the Watergate Hotel. It had also directed the FBI and even the Army to conduct unlawful surveillance on American citizens. The list of citizens the Nixon administration had spied on, it was staggering. And of course, in a story of Shakespearean proportions, Nixon was brought down by the evidence he had gathered, because the president had even bugged his own office. Secrecy and spying, that's not a climate conducive to a national data center, let alone to a network of government computers. But that's the climate the internet was born into. Paranoia about what the government knew and how it knew it.
NBC News has learned that the government has built a secret electronic intelligence network that gives the White House, the CIA, and the Defense Department instant access to computer files on millions of Americans.
Just months after Nixon resigned, a young NBC reporter named Ford Rowan began an investigation of his own into the last days of the Nixon White House. In a series of explosive reports on NBC Nightly News in June 1975, Rowan claimed to have uncovered yet another conspiracy, yet another cover-up.
the secret computer network was made possible by dramatic breakthroughs in the technique of hooking different makes and models of computers together so they can talk to one another and share information. It's a whole new technology that not many people know about.
He sounds a little like Vance Packard in The Naked Society, going on about how the government strips you down. Down to your bare ass.
If you pay taxes or use a credit card, if you drive a car or have served in the military, if you've had major medical expenses or contributed to a national political party, then there is information on you somewhere in some computer.
Then Rowan, without really explaining it, invokes the failed national data center proposal.
NBC News has learned that while Congress was voting down plans for big computer linkups, the Defense Department was developing exactly that capability, the technology to connect virtually every computer. The network, and it is referred to as the network, is now in operation.
NBC News has learned that the network computers are talking to one another. We don't know how or when it began. We do know this. One of the perpetrators is named Timmy the Terminal. The Department of Defense scratched its head at NBC's report. Everyone involved in building ARPANET must have scratched their heads. This supposedly secret network had debuted in a public demo in a hotel ballroom. Gerald Ford's White House issued an official denial. The White House was not connected to ARPANET, which was also not a secret network. But the Senate, still in a Watergate mood, opened hearings on surveillance technology. So, once again, we're back in a hearing room to talk about monsters and computer men on Capitol Hill. The Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense appeared before the committee and admitted that the Army had illegally conducted surveillance and kept files on American citizens involved in political protests. That story had already come out. But as for keeping those records on a secret computer network...
Let me emphasize that it is not a secret network, that it is used for scientific research purposes, that it contains no sociological or intelligence data on personalities, and that it is a marvel in many ways. But it does not fit the Orwellian mold attributed to it.
ARPANET was, and always had been, unclassified. The public was invited to its unveiling in 1972 at the Washington Hilton. The public just hadn't been interested. And not only had the public not been paying much attention to ARPANET, but the public had really not been paying much attention to private corporate ownership of data. In 1964, Vance Packard, wearing two pairs of pants, published The Naked Society, warning that computers were collecting data about you and stripping you naked. In 1975, the United States finally withdrew from Vietnam. In the decade between, the American public got alarmed about what the American government was doing with its data. Between Vietnam and Watergate, Americans lost faith in the federal government, fearing and having found out that the government knew things it shouldn't know and was hiding things it shouldn't hide. All this happened just when data was becoming easier to store and faster to process, and computers were beginning to be able to communicate with one another across vast distances. That part's just a coincidence. But there are patterns here, too. Patterns that you can only see from the vantage of history. Because meanwhile, the people who were really stealing and hoarding data? Corporations. And hardly anyone noticed. Maybe Congress is always too late when it comes to technology. I think Arthur Miller feels about this the same way I do. The National Data Center died, but then that monster came back, wielding that same rusty, bloody axe. It came back as the internet. And for my entire life, we've been having the same argument over it.
My God, I close my eyes and I say, I've seen this movie before. And it's just as bad as it was the first time.
That bad movie, it's still playing on C-SPAN. In 2018, when a subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee held hearings about Facebook data and privacy, Senator Orrin Hatch was 84 years old. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook was 33. And from their exchange, it was pretty clear that Hatch had no idea how Facebook works.
If so, how do you sustain a business model in which users don't pay for your service?
Here, Zuckerberg blinked.
Senator, we run ads.
Senator, we run ads. P people give us their data for free, and we sell it to advertising agencies and to other companies. This problem was never a technical problem. This problem, a half century old, was always a political problem. Where is your data? In the cloud. Where's the cloud? Everywhere. In data centers all over the world. What are the rules? There are no rules. The Last Archive is produced by Sophie Crane McKibben and Ben Netafhafri. Our editor is Julia Barton, and our executive producer is Mia Lobel. Jason Gambrell and Martin Gonzalez are our engineers. Fact-checking by Amy Gaines. Original music by Matthias Bossi and John Evans of Stellwagen Symphonette. Many of our sound effects are from Harry Jeanette Jr. and the Star Jeanette Foundation. Our foolproof players are Barlow Adamson, Daniel Berger-Jones, Jesse Hinson, John Kuntz, Becca A. Lewis, and Maurice Emmanuel Parent. The Last Archive is brought to you by Pushkin Industries. Special thanks to Ryan McKittrick and the American Repertory Theater, to Alex Allenson and the Bridge Sound and Stage, and to Simon Leake. At Pushkin, thanks to Heather Fain, Maya Koenig, Carly Migliori, Emily Rostek, Maggie Taylor, and Jacob Weisberg. Our research assistants are Michelle Gao, Olivia Oldham, Henrietta Riley, Oliver Riskin-Kutz, and Emily Spector. Thanks also to Rachel Henson at the Carl Albert Center at the University of Oklahoma, and to Stephen Kuehler at the Lamont Library at Harvard. I'm Jill Lepore.